UOP Multimedia presents The Ominous Continuity with Kevin Cole, creating insights on the history of Western civilization, international relations, education theory, technology, and current events. This is Episode 3, The Trivium and Empire, John Robert Seeley, Cecil Rhodes, and the Birth of the English Trivium Method. Hello, my name is Kevin Cole, and welcome to Episode 3 of the Ominous Continuity Podcast. In the last episode, I laid out an introduction into the works of John Robert Seeley, the role of technology in the creation of a cohesive imperial culture, the importation of the concept of organic unity, and the influence of Prussian nationalism in the 19th and 20th centuries. Today we're going to dive deeper into the English-speaking idea, as mentioned in the Last Will and Testament of Cecil John Rhodes, and the role of the trivium of grammar, logic, and rhetoric in fostering culture and a national consciousness that became a foundation for an entire imperial project. For those of you that'd like to explore some of my other research and work on the trivium, I would recommend viewing my appearance on History So It Doesn't Repeat, produced by Richard Grove of TragedyAndHope.com, entitled The Classical Trivium and the Trivium Method. You can also view this two-hour interview at UnityOfThePolis.com. Special thanks to everyone for tuning in and your ongoing encouragement and support. If you appreciate my research and analysis and would like to help fund my book and future projects of UOP Multimedia, you can support my work directly at UnityOfThePolis.com or at Patreon.com/KevinColeUOP. You can also do so by picking up a copy or subscription to my UOP Research Brain, which is a historical database and mind map containing over 11,000 individual entries and 27,000 links, which I've been compiling since 2009. If you have any questions, interview requests, topic suggestions, or anything at all, please feel free to contact me directly. With that in mind, this is The Ominous Continuity. Thanks for listening. The Trivium and Empire, John Robert Seeley, Cecil Rhodes, and the Birth of the English Trivium Method, by Kevin Cole. Beautiful city, so venerable, so lovely, so unravaged by the fierce intellectual life of our century, so serene, and yet steeped in sentiment as she lies, spreading her garden to the moonlight, and whispering from her towers the last enchantments of the Middle Age. Who will deny that Oxford, by her ineffable charm, keeps ever calling us near to the true goal of all of us, to the ideal, to perfection, to beauty, in a word, which is only truth seen from another side, nearer, perhaps, than all the science of Tübingen. Matthew Arnold, Essays in Criticism, as read to Cecil Rhodes on his deathbed in South Africa in 1902. All the pride and strength of an aristocracy comes from the sense of ancestry, and every member of a historic nation may have something of this sense, and something of the pride that springs from it. John Robert Seeley, English in Schools, 1868. In order to fully understand the basis of this English-speaking idea proposed by John Robert Seeley and adapted by Cecil Rhodes in his ideal arrangement for his secret society, it is first necessary to analyze Seeley's essay entitled English in Schools, published in 1868 in his book Lectures and Essays. This influential work was released only 2 years prior to the Mass Education Act of 1870 and anticipated many of its reforms, including the introduction into secondary schools of new methods of teaching modern languages. This Education Act of 1870 mandated the first state-run public education system in England and was intentionally modeled after the education system in Prussia, as relayed in the proposals and recommendations of British poet, cultural critic, and school inspector Matthew Arnold. Arnold's first-hand reports of compulsory education in Prussia led the way. In his school book Schools and Universities on the Continent in 1868, extolled the potential benefits for industrialist and Victorian society at large of introducing the middle and particularly the, quote, ignorant lower class to universal forced schooling. But the English Friends of Compulsory Education, in their turn, will do well to inform themselves how far on the continent compulsory education extends, and the conditions under which alone the working classes, if they respect themselves, can submit to its application. In the view of the English Friends of Compulsory Education, the educated and intelligent middle and upper classes amongst us are to confer the boon of compulsory education upon the ignorant lower class, which needs it while they do not. Matthew Arnold, Schools and Universities on the Continent, 1868. In 1869, Arnold followed this effort by publishing his most famous collection of essays, Culture and Anarchy, which claimed to have found a way to rescue society from the decline of religion and what he viewed as the looming anarchy if nothing was done. He sought to combat this anarchy by elevating, quote, culture to the forefront of the educational curriculum, or, quote, the best of what has been thought and said, a conception in direct lineage to Samuel Taylor Coleridge and what the German Romantics called Bildung. Arnold's intentions have been described by historian Terry Eagleton as trying to, quote, convert a sectarian, internally divided and visionless bourgeoisie, pragmatically sunk into its own material interest, into a cohesive, truly hegemonic class, capable of elaborating in the ideological sphere the predominance it has come to hold in history. Eagleton continued that, quote, to accomplish this goal, the bourgeoisie must be inserted into the organic totality of culture, that spiritual absolute which subsumes one-sided class interest in transcendental unity. More specifically, it must appropriate the civilized aesthetic heritage of the aristocracy in order to equip itself with a worldview capable of incorporating the proletariat. For Arnold, the aristocracy is losing political hegemony, and its historical successor, the bourgeoisie, is disastrously unprepared to assume it. Matthew Arnold's lasting influence on the creation of a national and compulsory education system in England cannot be understated, and the Education Act of 1870 became the catalyst for many of its reforms, the implementation of future compulsory education laws, and the importation of the organic system from Prussia that integrated primary, secondary, and higher education. For university education, Arnold wanted it to be centered on, quote, the great works of English literature and the final examination for honors and literae humanores. For Arnold, quote, literature was the privileged means by which the culture of a ruling elite was to trickle downward through the class structure to secure the hegemony of the values of that elite. English in schools to fortify the new national culture. In the years leading up to the extension of the educational franchise to the masses in the form of universal public education under state control, there was also concern that not only were the middle and lower classes woefully unprepared and uneducated, but also that the private secondary education system was not adequately maintaining the aristocratic classes either. John Robert Seeley proposed in 1866 to the Taunton Commission, who had been discussing new reforms, that English literature and the English language should be substituted for the standard classical Latin grammar in secondary school. This was the, quote, English-speaking idea, and it was greatly expanded upon in his 1868 essay, English in Schools, where Seeley explained that in order for England to create a new national culture, using the model of Prussian Romantic nationalism, it would first be necessary to create universal standards for shoring up the English language, and that doing so would ensure conformity of comprehension under the definitions of English terms and the original intent of the authorities. I think that an exact knowledge of the meanings of English words is not very common, even among highly educated people, which is natural enough, since their attention has been so much diverted to Latin and Greek ones. But the ignorance in this department of the class I have most in view, those who leave school at 14 or 16, is deplorable. It is far more than a want of precision in the notions attached to words. It is far more than a mere ignorance of uncommon and philosophical words. There is a large class of words in the language, originally perhaps philosophical, but which have passed so completely into the common parlance of well-educated people that they cannot now be called philosophical, but which remain to the class I speak of perfectly obscure. The consequence is that such people, in reading not merely abstruse books, but books in the smallest degree speculative or generalizing, constantly mistake the meaning of what they read. It is not that they understand their author imperfectly, they totally misunderstand him, and suppose him to say something which he does not say. It is no wonder that such persons have no turn for reading. In fact, it is scarcely to be wished that they should. But all this is plainly owing to the fact that they have never been taught English. While Seeley was in agreement with the classicists that the study of language is one of the most important areas of the curriculum, he disagreed with them on the way it should be taught, and stated that, quote, what I would do is make a universal basis of instruction in the language they omit altogether. He believed that with democracy expanding, education must extend its area and influence, because it now had to, quote, cultivate not only a new class, but a rude class, Much like Matthew Arnold, J.R. Seeley gave voice to the general Victorian-era contempt for the masses, who were viewed mostly as unredeemable, while also seeing it as his duty to undertake to educate a whole nation, to be made safe and acceptable for the refined culture. We have to educate a class who have none of these domestic traditions, no inherited refinement, no common stock of literature forming an intellectual atmosphere around every child. If we teach this class what we have hitherto taught to the other class, the result will not be the same. For them, the schoolmaster must do much more, because the parents in the home have done much less. To them, he must become a kind of priest or missionary of culture. He concludes that if, quote, the present classical system is inadequate already as the instrument of an education to a class, much more it will be found inadequate to civilizing of a nation. Seeley takes on the classicist argument that Latin and Greek should be the base languages of education, not because he didn't feel that Latin and Greek weren't valuable studies, but he thought they should be part of an advanced education outside of secondary schooling. He saw Latin and Greek as admirable mental exercises, but only to minds in a certain state and after a certain preparation, and he posits that most students who obtain a classical education either learn it too early in life or abandon it before it can be beneficial. Seeley not only believed that Latin grammar was too advanced to be placed in the education process, but also that it presupposes a certain preparation of the mind, that the higher classes gain from a cultured upbringing at home that the masses had not been exposed to. My conclusion, then, is that when classicists recommend Latin and Greek as being an admirable discipline for the mind, they are right indeed, but only if they speak of a mind considerably advanced. Seeley's proposal was to shift the traditional means of imparting the Latin language in the classics, known as the trivium of grammar, logic, and rhetoric, into higher or professional education. He advocated a common education for boys up to the age of 14, after which the Latin language learning would begin. For those that left school before 14, they would learn no Latin at all. For those that went on, Seeley argued that they would be much better prepared to appreciate and comprehend the Latin trivium after first undertaking to learn their own language and reflecting upon their own culture. The classicist ideal, up until that point that Seeley disagreed with, was that the English language should continue to be learned indirectly through the study of Latin and Greek. I do not quarrel with the principles of the classicist, but with their means. I would reach their goal, but in a different way. I think they are right in the importance they attach to words, but I would substitute English words for Latin ones. I think they are right in introducing boys to great works of genius, but I would substitute modern genius for ancient. In a word, I advocate a comprehensive and elaborate English education. Seeley expresses his empathy for any teacher who might be embarrassed to apply to English the methods he has been accustomed to use in teaching Latin. He contends that the two languages do not stand in the same relation to the pupil's mind, and because of this, a native language cannot be taught in the same manner as a foreign one. This has to do with the orientation of the student to the rules of a foreign language, where if a student doesn't know a rule, he breaks it, but in his native language, he observes it from habit, regardless of if he is aware of it. He points out that if one does not know a word in a foreign language, he seeks it out. However, in his own language, he rarely perceives his own ignorance and attaches some idea, right or wrong or half right, to almost every word he meets with. Whereas with a foreign language, the student has a definite problem to solve, and he has to find the meaning of the foreign words before him and to represent them in their English equivalents. When operating in his native language, he perceives meaning at a glance, and he has no other language in which to represent it. For Seeley, these observations were enough for him to proclaim, "It is impossible to teach English in the way in which you teach Latin, but it does not prove that you cannot teach English in some other way." The creation of the English trivium method for the English-speaking people. Let us introduce our native language as such, and not in the disguise of a foreign language. Let us give it a method of its own, as well as a place of its own, and find new bottles for new wine. J.R. Seeley. Over the next several pages, Seeley proceeds to lay out the curricular framework for the English trivium method of grammar, rhetoric, and logic. The first part of this course will be grammar. I would teach it carefully and with perpetual examples from English authors, but I would not make mere grammar a very prominent part of the course. In the learning of a foreign language, we know that when grammar is mastered, there remains a higher and more difficult acquirement, upon which, however, depends all fineness and niceness of scholarship, the exact determination of the meaning of words, and the distinguishing of synonyms. Now, in the study of one's native language, this may be fairly put much earlier, because the syntax, having already been practically taught in the nursery, requires much less attention. Seeley concedes that, quote, grammar systematizes a knowledge which the child already possesses, and that every boy comes to school a talking and reasoning creature. The teacher is then responsible for turning implicit knowledge into explicit. Staying consistent to the medieval trivium, Seeley's grammar for the English language, even as a native language, was to be imparted through poetry, elocution, learning the meters of English poets, and through the examples of English authors. In the medieval curriculum, these were known as the auctores, which goes back to the root of the concept of authority itself, or the authors, who established the founding rules and principles of each discipline, and ultimately impart the moral and political authority as a model for the early analogical reasoning of the student body. Next, he introduces rhetoric, but not meaning strictly the art of persuasion or oratory, but, quote, all those arts and contrivances by which a limited number of words are made to express a practically unlimited number of conceivable things. Of these, principle is metaphor, and I think it's important that the pupil's attention should be fixed on this subject long enough to make him perceive clearly what a large portion of language is metaphorical, and also to make him directly aware of the presence of metaphor when he meets with it in reading, and conscious of it when he uses it himself. Finally, Seeley explains that there's another, most important subject which may be conveniently coupled with English. I mean logic. He says the principles of logic are not too difficult for young boys, provided they're not presented to him in too technical a form. As every boy comes to your school a talking creature, so he comes to it a reasoning creature. The teacher has only, as I said before, to turn implicit knowledge into explicit. It will not be hard for him to show the pupil that when he makes general inferences, he uses induction, and that when he draws particular conclusions, he uses a syllogism. I would go no further than this than to bring out distinctly the notion of induction and deduction, and to make the pupil familiar with the syllogistic formula. But why connect this with English? For this reason. I'm presuming throughout that a series of English classical writers is being read in class, and that the problem is to draw as much instruction from them as possible. I've suggested first that the reading itself shall be accompanied with an explanation of the laws of elocution, next that the syntax of each sentence shall be investigated, next that the words shall be carefully explained, and that their shades of meaning brought out, next that the rhetorical contrivances, particularly the metaphors, shall be pointed out. But the analysis will evidently be incomplete unless we examine the writer's reasoning. For this purpose, we require logic. Seeley proposed that the auctors to be selected for each discipline should be those that are most attractive to young boys, that would then lead up to the older poets and philosophical writers. He also wished to make universal, in the middle of the course, Plutarch's Lives, Pope's Iliad, and Worsley's Odyssey as English translations. These were intended to substitute for the loss of the classics at this stage of learning and provide some basic and uniform knowledge of antiquity. Seeley's conception of the English trivium as a general education for the secondary schools was developed, quote, for a class which has no intellectual atmosphere around them. In the conversation to which they listen, there is no light or air for the soul's growth. It is a uniform, gloomy element of joyless labor, bewildering detail, broken with scarcely a gleam of purpose or principle. He believed that without this education, that one would be left in total ignorance of the literature of his own country, not merely uncultivated, but absolutely uncivilized. He can have no link whatever with the past. He can have no citizenship and no country. Classical studies may make a man intellectual, but the study of a native literature has a moral effect as well. It is a true ground and foundation of patriotism. Now that the American, the Germans, the Italians are almost drunk with their sense of national greatness, it would surely be well if our own population could be brought to think of England, otherwise than a country where wages are low, manners are very cold, and the struggle for life intolerably severe. The essay concludes with Seeley reflecting on this curriculum as perhaps seeming to be a most utopian dream. If we can judge what can be done by what has hitherto been done, we should pronounce it impossible that the lower half of our population could ever receive either cultivation or civilization. We should conclude that things must remain always as they have so long continued, and that a small number of cultivated men will always live in England in the midst of a vast half-barbarous population. We should think ourselves happy that this half-barbarous multitude belongs to the better class of barbarians, that it is hard-working, tolerably honest, and good-natured, and that its worst faults are narrowness and dullness. These revelations may cause some confusion for those who have been led to believe that the English trivium method was a lost tool of learning, or the prerequisite, as opposed to an analogy of the human reasoning process, that it's been purposely withheld from modern schooling nefariously in order to maintain control over society, that it's classical instead of medieval, or claims that it's been taken out of its, quote, proper order, so one can continue to justify its use as an empty vessel and cudgel from which truth, certainty, absolute principles, or a total education are alleged to be objectively derived. As I will continue to illustrate, these claims rely on sophistry and a syncretic amalgamation of this very lineage of John Robert Seeley, Cecil Rhodes, Matthew Arnold, in the educational perennialism of the late Victorian period through the mid-20th century. In reality, this trivium framework has been consistently employed as a system for imparting solidarity of language and culture and providing a uniform initiation into higher learning and expanding forms of the body politic, from the monastic traditions and medieval universities through state-controlled compulsory education. As explained by Seeley, the New English Trivium method was to employ the English language and claims of a superior logic, history, and tradition to justify the creation of a cultural unity for the British people and later for the English-speaking people within the empire. It is an enculturation process that leads individuals to be subservient to arbitrarily defined rules, collectives, and authorities who seek universal dominion for their mediums by subordinating the particularity and intrinsic value of outsider cultures and perspectives. This is accomplished through the management of language, oratory, and thought, which, like sense perception and judgment, are all inherent faculties of the human mind and are innate and instinctive predisposition to a universal grammar and local language creation. Historically, we see the, quote, uncivilized are cast as barbarians because they refuse to be brought under the rules and propaganda of the dominant monoculture and would instead fight to retain their own independent systems of value, no matter how dull or narrow they are deemed to be. In my next chapters, I will further explore how Cecil Rhodes and his followers helped proliferate this new English-speaking idea, which became the foundation for the Seeley Lectureships out of Cambridge, the Rhodes Scholarships at Oxford, and many affiliated programs introduced into the United States, where the trivium had been steadfastly rejected as a curricular guide after the American Revolution.